Accession number 28358, Reel 9.
And then my staff was increased. I had a cook boy to make the sandwich. Japanese cook boys make the sandwiches and make the tea. I had a nurse. I had a doctor on board. And I had the Red Cross ladies. I had a huge staff on this little train, which was really rather amusing because I had had some very busy periods doing it before on my own. And we went across. Oh, and as we were leaving Curie Station, I did several collections, and one of the times I was going off, the press tried to get on board, and it had to be ejected because we were told unknown, and any, we must not speak to the press under any circumstances. And anyway, we took the train off, and we got to Irukuni. And I went into the ward where these ex-POWs were waiting. And there, I can't remember how many on this occasion, maybe about 12, I'm not sure, maybe more, because they'd released them in dribs and drabs. And I felt quite overwhelmed. And I said, "We're so pleased to see you." And they were thrilled. And we got them back on the train and got them back to the hospital, and then the Australian nursing sisters looked after them. It was their turn to look after these POWs. And later on, I returned the ones that were fitter to be flown home. And they sort of treated me like a princess. It was really lovely to see them actually going home. They were so thrilled. I took them back by train to the airport, and they flew back to England.
End of Reel 8, Mrs. Jill McNair. Mrs. Jill McNair, Reel 9.
One of my patients I had on the train, it was very sad. This was before I collected the POWs. He was the captain of a Sunderland flying boat which had to ditch in the sea, and he'd lost part of his crew, and he was very upset. And at that time, I wasn't terribly busy on the train. I probably only had a handful of patients, and I spent some time talking to him. And later, I can't remember whether I knew at the time or it was later, but we had some of the crew that survived, but a lot of the crew were trapped in the water, and it was a storm, and they had a dreadful time. And this poor man was so upset at losing his crew. He felt he should have gone down with it. That was one of the things that sort of stuck in my mind.
The returning prisoners of war,
yes,
from Korea.
Yes.
When you picked them up to take them back to Curie, they would have just come out of Korea then.
Yes.
What sort of state were they in?
They weren't the first, I hate to call them back, the first whatever few I picked up were not too bad at all. They weren't what I, to be honest, what I expected they would be, or any of us expected. They probably had odd wounds and had been medically ill and were exhausted, but they weren't, and they were quite cheerful. But I think I did 2, 3, or 4 trips to collect them all, because they all came out in dribs and drabs, and I know the last ones were more poorly, and they had probably stayed on at a transit hospital somewhere en route to get some strength up before they came back to us, I imagine. And they were more poorly. I think they were probably more medically poorly than surgically by that time, because some of them had been in captivity for a long time. So,
did they say much about their experience to you in
no.
captivity, about the North Koreans?
No, very little. They were so pleased to be coming home, I think, and we were busy, and you see, I was busy my nursing duties. There were the Red Cross ladies doing letters for them, people lighting fags for them, and the doctor, and it was a very small, confined area. But the one day, I started at 5 in the morning, and I got back at 8 o'clock at night to the mess. There were long days like that. I mean, I didn't mind, it was all part of it. And one of the days I did go down to rehearsal afterwards. But then I was young.
Right. Well, if I could ask you now about going to Korea. You were saying earlier how you all wanted to go.
We did, right? And in the... Yes, that's right. And we had this rumour in September 1952 they were going to send people. This was confirmed in October 52. And they sent two QAs, two Australian sisters and two Canadians to Seoul to find a small hospital. It would be a medical hospital to relieve the front line of medically ill troops so that they could come down to Seoul, be looked after and nursed, and then if they weren't too ill, and then sent back to the front line without coming all the way out to Japan. This was very exciting news. And that was October, and the QAs were only allowed to do 2 months there because the conditions were rough and the winters were very cold. In December, early December 1952, Machen sent for me, and she said, Hall, you're being posted. I want you to go to Korea next time and to be the senior sister with, I think, a girl called Mary McDonald was going over as well. And I was absolutely thrilled to bits because I wanted to do it more than anything. This is December 1952. And unfortunately, the next day, Colonel Wright, who was a surgical specialist for the hospital, British, came up to me. Again, I was working on the officer's ward. He said, I want to speak to you. He said, I think you've got something wrong with your back, because I'd never walked terribly well and I was very bent, and we'd been working very hard, that's what it meant. And to cut a long story short, I said to him, do you know I've been posted to Korea? And I think it was sort of secret at that time, but I knew he would know. He said, I know, but you must get this straight. He said, I think you've got a DB spine. And so, anyway, to cut a long story short, I was furious, but he insisted I had my back x-rayed, and they discovered I have a deformity of my spine and this had been causing this, and he said I shouldn't, my posting was to be cancelled, and I was absolutely heartbroken over this. But anyway, I then did a long course of physiotherapy, and Matron was very nice. She said, I don't want you to go because the beds are collapsible beds in Korea and they're too low. At the time I was furious with everybody, and I realised how kind she was after. Anyway, I did my 3 months physiotherapy and various things, and my spine improved. And then I did this night duty with this heavy casualty ward up when I'd first diagnosed, but anyway, that's besides the point. Went on nursing in Japan until May 1953. Matron had said to me at the time, I will send you there, and I didn't believe her, of course, being young and much. But in May 53, I met the deputy matron. I was going over to the hospital, she was going over to the matron. Oh, she said, Hall. I was always in trouble with her because my hair was always untidy, just all sticking off. So I said, oh, God, what have I done now? And she said, Hall, your posting to Korea has come through. You're going in 2 or 3 days. And that was it. And I had a few days to pack up. And I was sealed to bits, so... at the time I was posted, I was advised to make a will. So I had no idea how to do this. So I scribbled something on a bit of paper and sent it home to my parents. Nothing to leave anyway. I had to pack up all my kits because they would need my room. And I stored any nice, valuable things with my friends. The rest of it I had to put into store. I was only allowed to take my khaki drill, because it was summertime, summer uniform, tropical kit then, and uniform. I wasn't supposed to take any civilian clothes at all, so going on active service. I had a short time to do all this. My friend was very helpful, and I got rid of all my junk and did it, and I had my anti-malarial pills, Paludrin and various things like that to take. And we also used to have to take salt tablets because it was so hot in Japan in the summer and got dehydrated. And then the day came, and it was about, I think, the 25th, 26th of May, 1953. and I had my orders, and I left the mess, you know, Tilly was like a jeep. I was driven down to the docks. My friend came to see me off, and I had my suitcase, black bag, probably a grip or something, very little stuff, and I'd taken a Japanese umbrella, because we use these beautiful pink waxed umbrellas to cover our veils, you see, and because we had these rainy seasons. And a tennis racket, which really wasn't the way to go to war, but I thought, well, there may be an opportunity to play tennis. And I got into this, I checked in to Sergeant Major, and I got into this launch, commercial launch, with all these soldiers in battle dress, combat gear, with guns and everything else, and I thought, that's it, Charlie. And I sat down with my suitcase, my pink umbrella, my tennis racket, going to war in my battle dress, khaki cap, and I felt absolute idiot. And they were embarrassed. But I was quite pleased, because it was very choppy. We steamed across the inland sea, which was a two-hour journey back to Okuni, you see. And the sea could be very choppy, and it was, and they were all going green about the gills. And I thought, well, I'm not going to heave up with this, not being the only woman, so I've managed. And we arrived at Iwakuni and checked in. And before I left, the matron said, whatever you do, Hall, do not be overweight with your luggage for the flight. And all I had to weigh my luggage on was a pair of bathroom scales in the hospital. We had to drag it over there. So anyway, I left my luggage, and we were given a sort of last supper. I ate in a mess with these men, and they were still a bit embarrassed because I was around. And then I was given a room, and we had about 3 or 4 hours sleep. We woke up at 4 and given a huge breakfast, and then went out to the airstrip and got into a Dakota. And I'd heard about these Dakotas when I was in Aldershot, because one of the MOs had been out in Korea. He said they always crashed. They weren't in a very good condition. Not that I was really worried about it then. But I got into this thing, and I'd only had one flight before, and I expected a comfortable seat. And they were just canvas litters across. And I had an awful difficulty doing up my straps, and I wasn't going to ask one of these men to help me. Anyway, I managed it, my safety harness. And we flew off at 5 or 6 over to Korea, and with the rising sun coming through the square window. And we dropped down on in a field at one stage in Korea to pick up stores and one or two troops. And I got out of the plane, I remember standing on the wet grass. And then we got in the wet again and flew to Seoul, to Gimpo Airport, which must have been badly bombed, because I can remember being given a mug of coffee in a tent there. And then the matron from the little hospital I was going to came to collect me, and she was very nice. Unfortunately, I cannot remember her name. She was a young Australian captain, and she was very friendly and welcomed me. And then we had a long jeep ride back from Gimpo to where our base was in Seoul, and saw quite a lot of devastation going through the city. It was bombed, and passed the Han River over the old Gerda Bridge. It was the only remaining bridge left in Seoul. All the other bridges had been bombed. Saw the women, who really looked like peasants, washing there, doing their washing on the stones underneath. Eventually got to, and I've never discovered, unfortunately, whereabouts in Seoul we were, to the British Commonwealth Medical Z Medical Unit, as it was called. I think it was British Commonwealth Zone Medical Unit, anyway. And stopped outside, there was a whitewashed wall and guards on the gate with a barrier, and the jeep stopped outside, and then the guard recognised Matron, saluted, and the barrier went up. We had several guards outside and into a sort of compound. And it was, I think it had either been an old agriculture college or a school. And Matron took me over to the mess, which looked like a school, an old Victorian fashioned building, European building, with two front doors, I think. And this was a mixed mess, which was most unusual for the QAs, but there were only at that time, there were 3 QAs in Seoul, and two Australians, and the two Canadians had decided to go up a bit further in a tent or something. I think there'd been some problem in Seoul, and they'd moved out anyway. Anyway, the matron took me in into this rather gloomy building and up some rickety stairs, and she said, "These are our quarters," which were two big rooms. One room was a sort of sitting room, which was very bare, had a sort of second-hand chairs and table and a bit of netting on the windows, but had been painted by one of the QA, so it wasn't too bad. And the other room, the quartermaster divided into cubicles, very small cubicles with plywood, so we each had our own little cubbyhole. And our shown man had a curtain over the door with a sort of collapsible bed, some orange boxes, which made useful shelves, a hook for my uniform. I think I had a locker, I'm not sure, and a stool. I may have had a chair. It was very basic, but it was fine. And I actually had a window, and I could overlook the hospital compound. And she told me when the meals were, the lunch was at one, I think, and it was a mixed mess. And she had seen me then, and I sort of recovered myself, went down to lunch. Was amazed at the quality of the food. It was wonderful, and we were on American rations, ice cream, which I hadn't seen for years, turkey, you name it, we had it. You know, that was the best thing about it. I thought I'd guess as fat as a barrel. And the matron said, "Take the day off because you're tired," because it was a long journey, which was very kind of her. And the other QAs with me, Jess Milton, was a senior QA, she was a captain. She was a regular. She'd also done the hospital train. She was always very kind to me. And I actually met her 40 years later, in fairly recently. And she took me in hand in the afternoon and showed me the hospital. The hospital was about 100 yards away, and it wasn't an old school. It was a modern building with crystal windows, some were broken. And a various collection of buildings. And the hospital was divided into, I think, three floors with wards, which were absolutely basic. They had a collapsible bed and a locker, the patients. But they had sheets and they had pillowcases, which was very important. We had no running water at all. I think the water must have come in bowsers, so we couldn't do any surgery there. And the water was carried up in buckets to the wards. And the same in the mess. I mean, I should have said in my bedroom, I had an enamel bowl on these orange boxes and a tin mug for washing. Jess took me onto what may have been a stable. It was a brick building. And I saw where a bomb had hit the place with a sort of crater or broken buildings near it. She said, "This is the shower house, and we are allowed to shower once a day between 4 and 5 because the shower house is used for everybody in the hospital, patients and everybody else." And the shower house, you walked in, and matron's bought these for you. They're pearl rubber, those little brass Korean shoes I brought back. But these are rubber shoes, that shape, blue rubber, which the peasants wore. Matron bought them in the market for us to wear on our feet, because the bricks were so rough for our feet in the shower house, which was this old stable. And the showers were all in together, one petrol can, gun and petrol can, and a string. And it was filled with lukewarm water. It was wonderful. and the trouble is, we were all in together, but that was okay. And then she said, "I'll show you the loo." Well, it wasn't called a loo then. It was a thunderbox. And we had a four-seater ladies' thunderbox. And it was all right. He sat next to the matron. He really didn't know what to talk about. It was very embarrassing. I mean, I'd seen them in the country, but never like that before. So those were our washing facilities. And the patients used to hang out of the windows when it was just a shower time, because we had to go across and, you know, take our towels and sponge bags across with us. And they would whistle at us all the way. But so those were the facilities. And in the morning, we had a little Korean maid, and she brought a jug of warm water for you to wash, and that was it. But anyway, it was all right. I was so looking forward to going to Korea, but the nursing was good, but it was not what any of us expected. Somehow we spent a lot of time with documentation. I don't know why. We had quite a lot of staff, a lot of orderlies from Canadians to, and they're very good too. And so the sisters were, I mean, there were only three of us, and one would have been on night duty, and one was the matron. So, five of us, that's right. And one on night duty, one was the matron, and the others, three shared the day duties. We looked after the patients. They were medically ill. We did all we could for them. We couldn't do any dressings really, because they had no surgery stuff, no water. One of my first encounters with a patient was, in our uniform, sorry, we wore our grey dresses. It was too hot to wear the tippets, so we just had our scarlet epaulettes and our rank on. But Jess was really in charge of me, and Cynthia Mills was there, but she went back to Japan, and another girl, Irene Chesters, came out, British girl. And Jess said, we won't wear our veils because you can't get them starched, you can't do anything, so we didn't do anything. But when we were admitting some patients, one of them came and he said, oh my God, there's a real sister here and real sheets on the beds. And I've never, and that was absolutely true, because we made them as comfortable as we could. And it was a very happy unit. We had a British CEO, a Canadian adjutant, an Australian matron, and we mixed very well. It was very happy. It was absolutely basic too, apart from the food, which was, as I said, was luxurious.
Who were the patients?
They were all Commonwealth troops, although we did have some Koreans in, because the Republic of Korea Army was fighting as well. And one night we had two Koreans in. They couldn't speak any English, and it was a bit difficult. And they were perfectly all right. There were Australians, Canadians, French Canadians, New Zealanders. I think we may have had an American in once or twice. There were anybody from the front line who would wanted medical treatment and a rest and recuperation, really.
Did you have any Turks? I think you mentioned at one time.
Later on, when I went out to Tokyo, there were Turks there.
Oh,
but I didn't actually come across them then. Mm. They were mainly those. One of the ambulance drivers was a Canadian who'd been the son of a Red Indian chief, actually. You could see had a very haughty, beautiful aquiline nose, and you know, they were very mixed. And I had French Canadian orderlies working for me, and everybody was very loyal, and they were very good. And I'd only been there two nights, I think, and I'd gone to bed early. It was a bit tiring. It's very hot and dusty out there too, and I hadn't actually gone to sleep. There was a hell of a bang and blast. I thought, that sounds like a bomb. And so we'd been instructed to rush over to the hospital if there are any bombs dropping or any air raids, you see. So I shot into my slacks and pull over, dashed downstairs, go run over to the hospital to help. And suddenly remembered I hadn't got my dog tags on, our identity disc, and I knew where that would be soon, so I shot back to get these. And then we all assembled in the hospital, and there were no more bombs. So bombs had been dropped, and the siren went off then after the bombs had been dropped. But so nothing else. We were up some of the night, but nothing else sort of spectacular happened that night.
Did you have other raids?
Sorry?
Were there other raids?
Oh, there were. We had a lot of air raids warnings after that, and they had... We used to, when I was on night duty, which was a bit later on, I did a week, and I, being night sister in charge, I got the alert first, and it just gave me time to go around and make sure we had candles everywhere before everything was blacked out, the whole of Seoul was blacked out, and then the sirens went off. We had no air raid shelters, we had no tin hats, but we used to carry the patients down on stretchers on the upper floors, and we would stay in the corridors for safety. And that was at the time on night duty then, that often the day staff, we might get these air raid warnings two or three times a night, you have to get up. I was all right, I was on night duty. And the patients, you'd have to wake them up. They were so used to these bombs and that, they wouldn't worry, but you'd wake them up and drag them downstairs. And they'd be cracking jokes. So this was where my training in Aldershot came into the fore, because Major McGeary had taught me how to make tea in a big bucket, and I had no teapot. So I made tea in buckets, and my office was called Jill's Grill eventually, because we had so many air raid warnings that week. And we sort of, we'd crack jokes, and then they, eventually got back to bed. They used to call it Bed Check Charlie. Bed Check Charlie was the nickname for the gooks. The North Koreans were called gooks by the troops. And when they used to, we had so many red planes circling over Seoul, and, at night, they were sort of mock air raids. Well, there were air raids, but they didn't really affect us at all. We were very fortunate, but we did have a lot of air raid warnings, and we were up and down and with the patients and that. So mm-hmm. We were very fortunate, really.
I suppose being a child in World War II,
yes,
this wasn't unfamiliar to
no,
you, really.
No, it wasn't at all. In fact, it was nothing, really. It was just a nuisance of having to get up if you were asleep, or on night duty it was no problem because I could sleep during the day. But it was fairly frequent. I think they were just trying to annoy people in Seoul doing it that way, I was trying to think. We had we used to see socially. We weren't allowed out unless we went out in pairs, and we had to sign out and sign in. But then there were so few of us that you knew very rarely you could get out. But I had a friend who was a Red Cross lady who came over to Seoul, which was lovely, and she was in the mess for a while, and she had access to a jeep and an armed guard. And she said to me one day, Jill, would you like to come into the American hospital where a lot of the British wounded are and come and talk to them? And just to get out of the place was wonderful. And so I went across with her. And it was very interesting to go to the, it was a huge American hospital with a helicopter pad. I hadn't seen a helicopter pad before. But driving over in the jeep, and if you managed to get out into Seoul, sometimes it was like being in a goldfish bowl, because you had choppers, we called them choppers overhead all the time. And often you could see patients strapped to stretchers on the sides of the choppers with blankets coming down. And I spent a morning talking to the patients, and Anne had gone off to do a lot of different things. The Red Cross worked very hard. And I was talking to one of the American nurses running the hospital, moaning about my hair because it was very difficult to get it cut off, do anything out there. And she said, oh, gee, come over to the nurses' home with us. Their nurses' home was lovely. They're all brand new Nissan hats, very comfortable. And she said, gee, your hair. She said, we've got our own hairdresser. So she said, would you like to get it done? I said, yes, please. So she took me off to another Nissan hut, and they had a trained Helen Rubinstein hairdresser and to do their hair, you see. Fortunately, I got some money with me, and he took one look at me. He was so rude. He said, gee, it's another bundle from Britain, and dumped me in a barber's chair, covered me with a cloth, and got his scissors out. And I'd last had my hair cut in Japan by a Japanese, and it wasn't very successful. Anyway, he really did a beautiful job, and a real Helen Rubinstein job, and it started to curl afterwards. So. And it cost me a whole dollar, which was 7 shillings and 6 pence, which was quite a lot out of my pay, but it was worth it.
End of real slide.
Am I talking too much?